We're discussing the volume of air traffic in and out of Wisconsin's largest airport. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport has added thousands of arrivals and departures this month. The budget airline Spirit is also breaking into the market, starting daily nonstop service to Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and Orlando. Have you traveled out of this airport in the pandemic? Was it for business or leisure? What do you think about flying out of Milwaukee? 800-642-1234. Joe Tashler is a reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers breaking news, weather, aviation, and grocery retail. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This is a treat.
Well, so we know air travel plummeted last year, especially during lockdowns. But what's the story for flying in recent months and this summer?
What's going on is airlines are moving flights around. One of the big axioms in the airline industry is airplanes are very movable. So what they're doing is they're moving aircraft and flights into markets where they think they can succeed. The trend is almost exclusively, at least right now, for leisure travel. So Mitchell International, since the beginning of this year, has 25,000 new airline seats available for travelers, and almost all of them are leisure. Everyone's still waiting for business travel to come back. But right now, lots of new seats.
Can you explain how the airlines measure seats? When you say, you know, Milwaukee has added more than 25,000 seats, what does that mean?
One of the way airlines measure their revenue and their profitability is how many people they can put in a seat on an aircraft and have that seat full as often as possible. So one of the things they use to measure is how many new seats are added into a market. And most travelers are going to look at the number of flights, that sort of thing. The way the airline industry, it kind of breaks it down on a really micro level is how many seats that they have available.
Yeah, and those seats are getting skinnier as time goes by.
Yeah, I think on Spirit, you can actually pay for a bigger seat.
Okay.
You can pay for everything on Spirit. So
what needs to happen, Joe, to keep these seats in Milwaukee?
Well, the biggest thing from what my reporting has determined is people need to use the service. Airlines, if they notice a particular route this is only flying, say, 50% full on the aircraft, they're going to take that aircraft and move it somewhere where they think that they can get more capacity or a higher, what they call load volume, more, which means more people on it. So the biggest thing is those flights have to be used in order to stay in the marketplace.
Yeah, so it's not like they're really committed to a certain market. It sounds like they can really move things around pretty quickly.
Yeah, especially in medium-sized markets like Milwaukee, where there's open gates. Now, if somebody was going to pick up and go to, say, LaGuardia or JFK, that's not as easy because all their gates are full. Those airports are at capacity. But in medium-sized cities like Milwaukee, there are gates available and they can put planes in here.
And I would imagine that it would be so much costlier to get a gate at LaGuardia or O'Hare versus one of these smaller medium city markets.
Sure, absolutely.
We're talking with Joe Tashler, who's a reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the changes at Milwaukee's Mitchell International Airport as travel picks up in these times. Do you travel through Milwaukee? What are you seeing? Have you been a frequent flyer in the pandemic? What's changed for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Joe, last week Spirit started flying out of Milwaukee. What effect can a new airline have on regional travel?
Well, one of the biggest things that we see is it drives down the price of an airline ticket. Anytime you introduce competition into the marketplace, especially in a deregulated, post-deregulation, and now I'm aging myself, anytime you introduce competition into the marketplace in the airline business, it drives fares down. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see that, especially on some of these really ultra competitive routes.
Yeah, like I priced out a random nonstop trip to Las Vegas in August on a random day, like on a Thursday. And you're looking at $42.59 one way, standard fare, $85 round trip. I'm wondering, is a price like that even sustainable?
If that was that on Spirit?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, that is sustainable because that fare you're going to pay for, if you check a bag, you're going to pay for a checked bag. If you have a carry-on bag, Spirit charges for carry-on bags. If you want a water or a drink on the airline, on the plane, you're going to pay for that. If you want a bigger seat, maybe a little more legroom, you will pay for that. So their bargain basement airfare does come with the fees.
It is at the basement, right?
Right. So they're going to upsell you, and their model works. I mean, they make money. So I would say that, yes, that is sustainable. Now, if you can get to Las Vegas with, you know, a toothbrush and a pair of socks, then you could probably do it for $85. So
another thing I noticed on Spirit, they're starting service to Manchester, New Hampshire, starting October 7th. And, you know, I'm wondering, I know fall leaves and all, but keeping service up to these smaller cities, that will be something to watch, I would imagine.
It absolutely is something to watch. I had a industry consultant tell me a while back that it was the spaghetti theory, where they're throwing spaghetti up against the wall to see what sticks. You know, I don't know enough about their route planning and the demand that they see. They have loads and loads of data. Every time you go to an airline's website and put in the destinations that you want to travel to, they record that. They know how many people are looking to go where and how many online hits they get to various cities. So, you know, whether they can sustain that to, as you say, some of the smaller or medium-sized cities remains a question, I think.
We're talking with Joe Tashler, reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering air travel through Milwaukee and what this uptick means for Wisconsin's largest airport. Have you bypassed Milwaukee's airport in the past and instead opted for Chicago's O'Hare? What was the declining factor for you? Are you a frequent flyer in the pandemic? What has it meant? What has it been like for you? Join in, air travel, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Joe Tashler here in the Ideas Network. Travelers are back at Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport. Air traffic is picking up. Is it here to stay? It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. After posting record low air traffic numbers last year, the airport is seeing a resurgence in travel, more destinations, more carriers. But is the demand sustainable? Have you traveled in and out of Mitchell? What are you seeing? Do you work in the airline industry or at an airport? Do you see more business or leisure travelers? Join in 800-642-1234. Joe Tashler is a reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the changes to aviation and he stays with us. So, Joe, I do want to address O'Hare. How does Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee compete with Chicago's O'Hare?
It does its best to compete with it. It's somewhat unique in that you have this behemoth airport 90 miles south that you can go to and you know, catch nonstop flights almost around the world.
Around the world, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, there's that term I think you've used before, passenger leakage. What does it... Yeah. Oh, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Passenger leakage refers to the passengers leaving the market in Milwaukee and leaking, I guess. I don't know who came up with that term, but going to O'Hare to utilize the air service there, it may be because there is more frequency, especially business travelers. They want to get there. They want to be there now. They want to be able to buy a ticket on the spot and get there. There's also the availability of nonstop flights. A lot of people don't like to make that one stop, where they're changing planes in a hub airport, or maybe not even changing planes. They don't want to make the stop. So, you know, customers or airline passengers look at their options.
And
O'Hare is one of them.
I've always, in all the cities I've lived in, I always see those billboards that say, you know, if you traveled out of this X airport, you'd be home by now, and trying to address that passenger leakage.
You know, if you're willing to make the 90-mile drive and put up with the, you know, especially the parking and some of the fees down at O'Hare, then, gosh, more power to you. Personally, I'd much rather fly out of Milwaukee.
We heard from Dennis calling in from Kenosha. Called, couldn't stay with us. Dennis is a frequent flyer out of Chicago and Milwaukee. And Dennis said, look, a lot of times it is less expensive to fly out of one or the other. And so Dennis regularly flips which one Dennis ends up going to. Often looks for fares at nearby airports. And as an example, Dennis says, like Manchester, New Hampshire, not far from Boston. So, Dennis makes a point there to check around.
Well, no question. I've spent years trying to figure out airline pricing structures, and I think it's impossible. you can just take New York. You can look at fares to, say, Newark or LaGuardia or JFK, and they're all over the place. No question. And again, no question is shopping around. If price is one of your main concerns, and, you know, let's not kid ourselves, price is a big concern for just about everybody. If that's your main concern, then absolutely, he's right. You know, look around, shop around, see what's there.
We're talking with Joe Tashler, who covers aviation for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're looking at air travel trends at Wisconsin's largest airport with your insights as well. Have you bypassed Milwaukee's airport for O'Hare? What was the decision there? Do you work at a regional airport? What have you seen in the past year in terms of air travel and traffic? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So Southwest carries more than half of Milwaukee's airport passengers. I was a bit surprised. I don't know why. Is it common for one airline to dominate the airport?
You know, yes, in terms of medium-sized cities like Milwaukee, Kansas City. So you look across Southwest's route network, and they dominate airports in Milwaukee, Kansas City, St. Louis, Baltimore, I believe BWI, they're number one in passengers. So, and that's part of their strategy. They go into markets that were previously underserved and go in and very quickly become the dominant carrier in that marketplace.
How has Southwest been doing in the pandemic?
You know, out of all the major airlines, and this surprises me too, but Southwest carries more domestic passengers, so more passengers in the United States than any other airline. They were more financially positioned much better than some of the other legacy airlines in terms of debt and the amount of money that they burn through each day. Their latest securities filing with the SEC showed that they were almost back to pre-pandemic levels in terms of the number of passengers. So they are coming out of this fairly quickly. And one thing that they've done during the pandemic, while air travel just literally almost evaporated, especially in March and April of 2020, as they started expanding and adding routes in places where their route planners thought that the traffic was going to come back first
and
fastest. So you've seen them add a number of flights from Milwaukee as well as a number of airports around the U.S.
Do you think the federal COVID relief aid that went to these carriers, has that had anything to do with their ability to expand routes, to expand service?
You know, I don't think there's any question that it has impacted that and allowed them to expand service. When you look at the amount of money, this is a capital intensive industry. You are talking that they burn through millions of dollars every day just to keep planes flying, you know, serviced, maintained. And there's no question that the lifeline in terms of that money that came from the federal COVID assistance played a role in helping them not only stay afloat, but also expand routes.
Yeah, take more risks. Let's bring in a call now. Bob is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Bob. Where are you flying?
We just got back last night from San Diego, 2-week trip, Milwaukee via Las Vegas to San Diego. So that's a total of 4 flights.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was full. Every flight was full.
Wow.
Things are coming back.
And may I ask what airline you flew on?
Southwest.
You flew Southwest, and it was all full. What was it like at San Diego in terms of congestion at the airport versus Milwaukee?
Yesterday morning in San Diego, it took us a half an hour to check the bags. We stood outside, took a half an hour to get to finish to checking the bags.
Mm-hmm.
And another 10 or 20 minutes to go through security. So if we hadn't had bags, we could have gone right to security, you know. So
yeah.
San Diego was very, very busy. Las Vegas was, well, I hate to say it, but it was a zoo.
Yeah.
Las Vegas was incredible. That was the, you know, if you're going to San Diego from Milwaukee, you either have to go through Las Vegas, Denver, or Phoenix.
Well, Bob, yeah, thank you for those observations. You know, as we wrap up here, Joe, Mitchell is owned and operated by Milwaukee County. Does the airport's success or failure impact the county's operations and its budget?
No, the airport, is completely self-supported. So it's supported by user fees, things such as gate fees. There is no property tax revenue, and no county general fund money comes from the county to operate the airport. It is a self-operating entity, if you will.
We only have a couple seconds left here, but what are you watching for out of aviation in Milwaukee?
The return of business travel. That is the biggest issue right now. Everybody's waiting to see what it's going to look like when it finally returns.
Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Like I said, this is a treat.
Joe Tashler, a reporter and editor for the business desk of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ahead this hour, a psychologist discusses coping strategies in the pandemic. We look at how other disasters around the world can inform quality of life in these times. We hear from the head of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about leaving home and finding a new one.
In the mid-1970s, Lisa Chu Tao and her family had to leave their whole world behind, their farm, their friends, their home. They lived in northwest Laos, and the horrors of war were creeping in. So they started walking and ended up in a refugee camp. In the 1980s, Lisa moved to Eau Claire and raised her family there. She shares that experience in this essay, which is read by her daughter, Yia Lor.
When I walk along the Chippewa River, I'm reminded of another river in a place I once called home. Although thousands of miles away, Guqingjia, I have not forgotten the dirt path I walked to fetch water. I have not forgotten the stream that followed me to the garden. I have not forgotten my Hmong village in Laos. When it happened, I was too young and didn't know what to make of it. What child can piece together the meaning of war? My family lived in Sayanbili province. We were farmers and knew little about the world outside our village or the war that had begun before I was ever born. One December night in 1974, some relatives came to say they were leaving. The war was coming. They tell you the. Despite this news, my family stayed. We cut trees to prepare for our garden. We burned the land and planted rice. We were farmers after all. Then in April of 1975, many Hmong people came to rest along the road by our house. They carried with them their belongings, and they delivered the same message. We cannot stay. We must go. The war is here. I was 9 at the time. My parents handed me my 2-year-old sister and asked that I carry her while they carry the rest of our belongings. Whatever we could not bring would be left behind. I tried to carry my sister, but could not. My parents handed me some belongings instead, but they were too heavy. Feeling the weight of the world on my shoulders, I cried. I cried because I could not carry my sister. I cried because I could not carry our belongings. And I cried because I could not carry the life I only knew. We left our village with hundreds of other Hmong people and never looked back. The paths in the jungles that we walked had already been paved by the hundreds that came before us. As we carried on, we cried. In October of 1976, we finally crossed the border into Thailand. It was in a refugee camp where I spent the rest of my youth trying to make sense of my past and look to the future. It was also here where I married my husband. One day, he suggested we apply for resettlement. We had an 11-month-old son and decided we would go for our little family. We would go for those who have yet to come. With that decision, we became names and numbers written on a chalkboard, paperwork filed away, a statistic, the aftermath of war, perhaps the forgotten. Then in 1987, we were sponsored by a Catholic diocese and left behind the land we first called home, a place where we played as kids, farmed and fell in love, and witnessed the death of those waiting for freedom. America became my new home, and Wisconsin's snow-covered hills and cornfields replaced the jungles and rice fields of Laos. I have tried to find my Hmong village on a map, but it is not labeled like Eau Claire. The river that ran through it is not drawn with a thin blue line like the Chippewa River. Perhaps my village and its river no longer exist, but Guching-Yaw. I remember the dirt path I walked to feed our chickens and pigs. I remember the teapot we used to boil water from the stream. Thousands of miles and over 50 years later, Guching-Yaw.
That was Eau Claire writer Yia Lor reading an essay written by her mother, Lisa Chu Tao, who also lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the pandemic, it is a disaster, but it's not like a one-time terrible earthquake or a devastating flood that strikes in one fell swoop. COVID keeps infecting people, keeps sickening and killing people, and the measures we're taking to lessen its spread are affecting work and our social needs as humans. But what is known about weathering past disasters that can help see us through this pandemic? Amy Nitza is director of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health at the State University of New York at New Paltz. She talked with WPR host Keely Baltina around the one-year anniversary of the U.S. shutting down to try to slow the spread of COVID.
You've responded to disasters around the world. Which of those comes to mind when you compare the COVID-19 pandemic?
I think the closest situation or set of situations that come to my mind right now are around the ongoing series of disasters in Puerto Rico. So Hurricane Maria was felt almost island-wide in Puerto Rico. And even as the recovery from that was still being implemented, then the earthquakes started, and the earthquakes were unpredictable and ongoing and were happening even as people were trying to figure out, like I said, how to recover from Hurricane Maria. And then almost just as those earthquakes were coming to an end, then COVID hit. And so there's just been these waves of ongoing disasters that people are trying to get their feet back underneath them in terms of recovering from something while there's still something going on. And I think the waves of different experiences that people have had related to COVID in terms of this sort of acute but yet chronic nature of these things is the closest representation that I can think of. You know, we started this last year, I think, all sort of sprinting what has now become a marathon, and the need to sort of think about this as a long-term thing, but also care for ourselves and those around us in these acute waves of particular stress that are different for everybody and that come at different times, whether it's around someone's job situation or their children's school situation or the illness itself or the politics or the context or the, you know, the racial injustice and racial trauma that's been layered on top of this for people.
One of the defining characteristics of this pandemic is its unequal impact. Some groups are more vulnerable due to pre-existing conditions or the nature of their work. And then there are people with middle-class jobs or who are healthy. They've done okay, maybe even saved money or gotten ahead. How do we reconcile this with the suffering?
In some ways, that's going to be the defining question of this. And in any disaster, what we typically will say is that comparing your loss to someone else's doesn't change the impact of the loss on yourself, right? So we really do encourage people to let themselves acknowledge and accept and grieve whatever their own losses and their own pain have been. And for an individual, it's typically not helpful to say, well, someone else has it worse than I do, therefore I shouldn't be feeling how I'm feeling. So at the individual level, I think it's really important for everyone to be able to acknowledge whatever their loss is and its impact on them and address it directly without that minimizing or comparing. That's at the individual level, but then at the broader, you know, community or society level, we all came to this from a different place, and therefore it's impacting people in different ways. And we certainly don't want to minimize the disparity. And we have some long-term work to do that predated this and that will continue on afterwards. But certainly if there's an opportunity at any time to recognize and address those disparities directly, I think this is it.
What about survivor's guilt? Really, when we wonder why we're still here when someone we love has died or we see how many people have died, is there a way to put those feelings to use?
Let me step back one step from that and again acknowledge that survivor guilt is a real thing, and it has, it can be really crippling for people if left unaddressed. And we've seen this, unfortunately, in some other situations after school shootings in particular. I'm thinking of the Parkland shooting, and there were survivors who really suffered from this to the extent that suicide was involved for at least one. So it's real and it's painful. And the first step there for any individual, again, is to be able to acknowledge and get support for what it is that they're feeling. These are questions without answers, right? The questions of why me or why not me? Why did this happen to my friend and not me? Those are sort of unanswerable questions. And we all need support from the people around us as we wrestle with them and try to make meaning of them.
Amy Nitza is a psychologist. She specializes in mental health training with an emphasis on disaster mental health and trauma recovery. You're listening to the Ideas Network as we talk about strategies we can use from other disasters to help people get through the pandemic. And Amy, this pandemic has people playing so many roles. How is that different than other disasters that affect certain people directly and then have other people respond to them?
Yeah. After what one might call a typical disaster, there are a set of responders who are working to help a set of survivors. And I should say, and in those disasters, those are two defined populations. And then there's a bigger set of people who just are aware of the situation, but aren't directly impacted. And so in the current situation, really the line between survivor and responder is blurred almost to non-existent in some ways, because almost everyone around the globe has been impacted in some way, as we're all survivors of this in one way or another. Obviously some frontline workers way more than others, but we are all survivors and we are all responders in the sense that we're all living with or working with other survivors, right? And so even those of us who aren't working directly on the front lines are home with our children who are survivors of this thing, or we're meeting every day with colleagues who are also stuck at home and are also survivors in the same way that we are.
Well, the images that come to mind when we talk about disasters are things that are brutal and physical. People being pulled from the rubble, first responders struggling to keep people physically alive. That is what happens in disaster. But what should we realize about mental health when thinking about this?
One of the many ways this disaster is different than others is that mental health is leading more than trailing behind in terms of what people are aware of and how people are aware of the impact on themselves and those around them. Often in the kinds of disasters you just described, mental health is sort of the last thing that people think about, if they think about it at all. And I think we are really now at a pivot point because we're seeing it and feeling it in ourselves and in those around us, of being aware of the mental health impact as a leading sign or symptom. And that can really range for people in terms of, a set of emotional symptoms or reactions, a set of cognitive symptoms or reactions, behaviorally, interpersonally, we may have symptoms or reactions, and physically as well. physical symptoms directly related to the mental health impact of this. And so a range of emotions that we're feeling more intensely than usual, anxiety, depression, sadness, fear, anger, guilt, as you mentioned. So we're experiencing those perhaps more than usual. They might come in bigger or stronger waves. We might lose the ability to regulate those emotions in the way that we typically are able to. And that can result in, you know, really in experiences of anxiety and depression. And the rates of people reporting those symptoms are way, you know, 2, 3, 4 times what they were prior to the pandemic.
That is psychologist Amy Nitza talking with WPR host Keely Boltina. They recorded this conversation in mid-March. There is more to learn about how Nitza sees disaster mental health strategies helping people around the world trying to cope with this pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show, and this conversation continues in a minute on the Ideas Network. On a Wednesday, thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. More than 600,000 people in our country have died from COVID. More than 33 million cases have been confirmed. That's according to the latest from the CDC. And whether you're personally affected by those numbers or you're trying to fathom what they mean, psychologist Amy Nitza says people are experiencing trauma from this global disaster. Nitza has been close to disasters. She's helped people in Puerto Rico, in Haiti, Botswana. Let's get back to her conversation with WPR host Keely Boltina. They spoke in mid-March.
People have watched numbers in this pandemic. We've tracked infections and deaths and hospitalizations. Now we're tracking vaccinations. Those rising numbers offer hope, but we're still very much in crisis. How do we keep going?
One of the things that we've really been incorporating into the training that our institute has been offering is in thinking about strategies of rehearsal, strategies that you can practice every day to sort of strengthen the mental muscle, if you will, that we all have around being able to stay resilient and being able to recover back to a sense of emotional and mental balance when we are tipped out of balance by these levels of stress. One of the things I really want to emphasize here is that there's not one right way to do this. There's not one practice that I could recommend to you that is going to work for everyone. What's more important is that people pick something that works for them, that feels good enough to them, that they can do it regularly. And then do that thing regularly so that it becomes almost a habit. We can't learn something new. It's really hard to learn something new when we're under conditions of extreme stress. And so when those waves of extreme stress come, we want to have pre-existing strategies built in that we can easily draw on in those moments. For some people, those are things like mindfulness. There's a lot of good science and good data around mindfulness practice and its benefits in helping us be able to regulate ourselves emotionally and mentally and physically. But that doesn't necessarily work for everyone, and not everyone's willing to try that. So there are also other cognitive-based strategies like stress inoculation and other sort of mental rehearsal strategies that can be useful. And there's so much benefit to physical exercise as a mental well-being practice in terms of being able to close up the stress cycle once we are triggered into a period of stress. So really there are physical strategies, there are emotion regulation strategies like mindfulness, and then there are cognitive-based strategies like stress inoculation, and then any other thing that just feels good to somebody that you can do regularly, you know, cooking, coloring, whatever it is that feels good to you that you can make a habit is our best recommendation there.
Even if or when we get a handle on infections, there's damage that remains. I mean, what mental effects could this have on people as we try to create a new normal? Things like even social anxiety with society reopening and seeing crowds.
Yeah. I think some of that remains to be seen. And there are some, you know, really good researchers working on that right now, trying to figure that out. We do have lessons from, you know, from SARS and other previous pandemics, but I'm not sure any of it quite applies in this context. In the disaster world, we talk about the goal of mental health interventions in terms of returning people to their, you know, pre-disaster level of functioning. So not about solving all their problems, but about getting them back to that, to the baseline of where they were before. And for all of us, that's going to look a little bit different. So I think thinking about it in those terms of like, what is it that feels different? And is there any of this that I want to hold on to? And is there any of this that I want to get rid of? And then thinking about that for each of us, the best way to do that is going to be different. I think that I want to always offer that it's hard to go wrong in terms of thinking about the benefits of therapy for people and having a neutral person who you develop a trusting relationship with, who can support you in identifying the changes specifically that you're experiencing, and then helping you make a plan for getting recovering from those, from whatever those changes are that you've experienced, and then working with you to support you so you don't have to be suffering from any specific diagnosis or disorder in order to benefit from therapy as a part of this process.
Even when the U.S. gets the coronavirus under control, other countries are struggling. This is global. How do we make sense of that overwhelming fact?
I think it's really easy in lots of ways to get overwhelmed by so many of the facts related to this situation. One of the keys that we've been finding is for everyone to think about which are the pieces of this thing that I can control and which pieces of this thing are just things that no matter how much I wish I could control, I can't. And even sorting those out by writing it down. There's something about writing something down that helps you have a sense of power over it or a little bit of control over it. But if you know, for anybody who's distressed about any specific piece of this situation, get out a piece of paper and you make a list of as specifically as you can. What are the aspects of the situation that are causing me distress right now? The fact that I keep having to rearrange my work schedule to meet my kids' school schedule, or the fact that I lost my job, but even within losing your job, what are the specific pieces of that? So breaking it down into its smallest components of what's stressful about it, and then taking that list and sorting it out one more time into the pieces of this thing that I have control over and those that I don't. Because one of the things that we know increases people's distress is continuing to try to change something that you don't have the power to change. And the global situation here, most of that, for most of us, we don't have a lot of control over, right? But if you look back at that list, there are pieces of it that you do have control over. And when you can identify what those are cognitively, then write out a strategy. Now you can make a plan for, you know, thing A and thing B and thing C. Now that I've identified it's this specific piece of this that is causing me a lot of distress, what can I do about that? Brainstorm a list, right? And then choose a strategy, something like that.
Amy, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that psychologist, Amy Nitza, who is a disaster mental health expert. Her latest book, it's called Disaster Mental Health Case Studies, Lessons Learned from Counseling in Chaos. She talked there with WPR host Keely Beltina about coping with the pandemic. You can find a link to trainings from the Institute for Disaster Mental Health at State University of New York at New Paltz. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we explore the rise of doubt, tracing a century of fake news and misinformation with a Harvard historian whose podcast is called The Last Archive. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.